this week, I had read online something that a pastor wrote, and it seemed fitting because he seemed to have the same sort of feel going on. He said, "The year will have a notoriety among its fellows as a year of calamities. In reading the newspapers during the last 2 weeks, even the most strong-hearted must have been the subject of very painful feelings. Not only have there been catastrophes so alarming that the blood chills at their remembrance, but column after column of the paper has been devoted to calamities of a minor degree of horror, but which, when added together, are enough to astound the mind with the fearful amount of sudden death which has of late fallen on the sons of men. We have not only one incident for every day in the week, but two or three. We've not simply been stunned with the alarming noise of one terrific clash, but another and another and another have followed upon each other's heels, like Job's messengers, till we have needed Job's patience and resignation to hear the dreadful tales of woe." The interesting thing to me about the fact that he wrote that is it was by a man named Charles Spurgeon. The year he was writing about was 1861. No generation goes by that we don't face heartbreak, that we don't face calamities, that we don't face tragedies of one sort or of many. And there are personal tragedies that we have with people we know. There's worldwide tragedies of things that are happening in other countries, and we just grapple with it. What are we supposed to make of this? Are we supposed to break down and cry every time? Are we supposed to just harden our hearts so that we don't have to every time? And my friend's suicide this week, I can't call it a courageous thing. There's really no good light that I can try to paint it in. So how do we respond? Once again, Jesus is our example. Jesus had a friend that committed suicide. You know that, right? Judas. And we're so used to just hearing the story told like Judas the bad guy the whole time that when the bad guy dies at the end, we don't feel bad about it. Heck, he's the one guy who has been able to make a kiss, something so intimate, sound bad. You just put his name in front of it. Judas kiss, and no one wants it anymore. But if we look at what happened throughout his life, or at least through the small time that he knew Jesus, Judas was a man that God put into Jesus' life. And Jesus knew he was there for a purpose. We don't know how that first interaction started, but I doubt that Judas was sitting around thinking, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to find somebody who seems really spiritual and try to mess up their life. He'd heard about this Jesus who is speaking with authority, and crowds are excited, and he's healing people, and it's amazing things. And he had some kind of a hope that there is something incredible to see. And so he goes to watch, and he's going around with Jesus. He becomes one of Jesus' disciples, a guy who follows Jesus around to the cities he's going to. And one night, Jesus goes up on a mountain, and he prays all night long. And in that conversation, it sounds like God says, "Jesus, I want you to choose 12 men from your followers. Here are the 12 of them. Peter and James and John and Andrew and Bartholomew and Nathaniel, Matthew, down to Judas." So Jesus has had God tell him, make this man a part of your life and invest in him. It says Jesus called the disciples to him. He picked these 12 men that they could spend time with Jesus, that they could be with him, they could know him, and that he could send them out and preach. And when we see what Judas did, Jesus has the 12, and he sends them out. He says, I'm going to send you out to various cities. I'm not going to go with you. You go out, and here's what you're supposed to do. Tell people that the kingdom of God is close by, and heal people. Cast out demons. Raise the dead. Share the good news. And they did it. Judas went and told people the good news about Jesus. Judas, as far as we know, as far as we can tell biblically, laid his hands on people and they were healed. He cast out demons. He was a part of all of this. Jesus invested his life in this man and must have cared about him a lot. And yes, Jesus took time to rebuke him. On one of the days before Jesus was going to be crucified, there's a story, a woman named Mary comes and anoints Jesus' feet. And Jesus' disciples get kind of all upset about this because they said, this is so expensive what she's just done. She should have used that money to buy something for poor people. There's something better she could have done than break this perfume on Jesus' feet. And we're told that Jesus says, you don't get it. What she did is a good thing. And Judas is one of the ones he speaks directly to. He says, Judas, you don't get it, do you? And we're told that Judas had greed in his heart, and he wasn't really thinking about the poor. What he really wanted to do was use the money, because sometimes we're told he would take money out of the little package. And we don't know exactly why Judas decided to betray Jesus. Money seems to have been part of what was on his mind. Because he, after this time of Jesus rebuking Judas, not long after, he goes to these ruling people and says, what will you give me if I find a way to turn Jesus over to you? And so they say, well, we'll give you 30 pieces of silver. He says, done. I'll help you out with it. But I don't think Judas really wanted Jesus to die. The way that he reacts later, it seems like that wasn't his intention. Maybe he was just frustrated with Jesus, and so he's like, fine, I'm going to show you. Maybe he was trying to then steal the popularity because Jesus was the one that always got paid attention to, and then if Jesus is out of the way, he could. We don't know. But Jesus, knowing what Judas was doing, how did Jesus respond to even that kind of betrayal and tragedy? Told that on the night that Jesus is going to be betrayed, knowing that he will be betrayed, he calls his 12 together and he says, I want to have a meal with you. I've eagerly desired to eat this meal with you. And while the stuff is being prepared, we're told that Jesus knew that his time was coming close, and he knew that God had put all authority in his hands. And Judas, already being ready to betray him, Jesus stands up from the meal. He takes off his outer garment, wraps it around him, gets some water, and he starts to wash his disciples' feet. Jesus, knowing he's going to be betrayed, Jesus, knowing he's going to die, and Jesus, knowing exactly who's going to do it, walks directly up to the man, gets down on his knees in front of him, takes his feet and starts to wash them, is a servant to this man, does something that would be seen as shameful in this culture, and he's willing to even go to the point of shame to serve and love this man, who he knows is going to betray him. And he knows that even that action isn't going to change anything. That's a question that's hard for us to answer. If you were told by God that you will invest your heart and soul into someone and love them with all that you have and serve them and know that they won't change, would you still do it? Jesus did. And I believe that we should follow that example. That night, after Jesus has washed their feet and they're having the meal, is when Jesus institutes communion. This time where he takes the bread and he says, this is my body broken for you. He takes the cup and said, this is my blood spilled for you. And if you look at all four of the Gospels, it's honestly hard to tell exactly when in the meal that happens and when Judas leaves. In Luke 22, Jesus took the cup, gave thanks, take this and share it among yourselves, for I tell you, from now on I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. And he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, gave it to them, and said, this is my body, which is given for you. He goes on and says, in the same way he also took the cup after supper and said, this cup is the new covenant established by my blood. It is shed for you. But look, the hand of the one betraying me is at the table with me. Sure makes it sound like Judas is sitting right there, doesn't it? The hand of the one who's going to betray me is sitting at this table He's just said, this is my blood. I am going to die for you. Judas was sitting there as Jesus is explaining, I will die. It is for you. Maybe he even looked Judas in the eye. And how you can just sit there and see a man who's saying, I know what you're going to do, and I'm doing this for you anyway. So he does betray Jesus, and Jesus is taken before authorities and sent away, and they're going to try to get him crucified. And then we're told that Judas changes his mind. Matthew 27, we're told he changed his mind and he deeply regretted what he'd done. And so he brings back the money to the chief priests and the other Jewish leaders, says, I have sinned, for I betrayed an innocent man. And they say, well, that's your problem. The man is so heartbroken that he throws the money back. The thing that he seemed to want, this isn't what I really wanted. I didn't want it to end this way, but it is. And then out of regret, he hangs himself. When I was 13 years old, was the first time that I had a friend tell me that they had considered and attempted suicide. I was 22 years old when I had a friend who actually did. I'd been married for less than 2 weeks. I was on my honeymoon when I found out that my cousin had committed suicide. And then I was a pastor for less than 1 year when I had a friend who was able to legally do that. One of them had been abused and was still grappling with that, and that had affected her mentally, physically, emotionally, all of it. Another one seems that because of use or abuse of both prescription and perhaps illegal drugs, didn't even know what was happening. Hadn't left a suicide note. The way that it looked was just he didn't even realize that what he had done ended his life. And then another had a physically debilitating disease. Some things when it comes to depression. We as people, if you look through the Bible, we're not just material. We're just not skin and bone. We're not just chemicals. We're not just hormones. We're not just all of that. There is a very real spirit inside of us. There is something higher. God is spirit. We must worship him in spirit and truth. There is the spirit to it, and we can't neglect that. At the same time, the greatest honor that God ever did to our physical bodies was being willing to put himself inside of one. Jesus, he walked around like this. And one of the dangerous philosophies at the time when the New Testament was being written is there were these people that said, you know what, the spiritual is the only thing that matters, and this physical stuff is either all evil or all unimportant. And if you know how to look for it, it's very clear in what Paul writes and what John writes and what Peter writes that they're fighting against this idea that, oh, physical doesn't matter, it's all spiritual stuff. So we cannot neglect the physical either. And so often, if people are dealing with struggles, there is physical aspects to it, there are soul aspects to it, which is our mind, our will and emotions, and there are spiritual aspects to it. And it is unfortunate that there are people who are told, oh, if you're facing depression, it must just be because you're not spiritual enough. Not that there are not demonic influences that affect people, and it certainly can. But know that we're people that have been put together and have many angles. And honestly, yes, I do think that there are people who are more perhaps genetically geared toward having certain problems. In fact, that follows scientifically. And it may not be your fault that you have faced depression, or it might not be your fault that you struggle with certain things. You may not have been responsible for the cause, yet we are responsible for what we will do. And so there are people who are more genetically predisposed towards getting angry because of certain chemicals and things, and yet you're responsible for not attacking people. There are people who are more disposed towards various types of sexual desires, and yet we are responsible for how we use those or don't use those to act in a way that is godly. And so with depression, the same thing. We are responsible to seek help. And yet as Christians, we're responsible to help others. You don't have to feel ashamed of struggling with depression. We've sometimes got this idea that God prefers the really strong people. Like, that's what God really wants us to be. And if you're not strong enough yet, then God will kind of give you some time to get stronger before he'll really like you or get close to you. Which doesn't fit with what I see in the Bible. Psalm 34, verse 18, God is close to the brokenhearted. He saves those who are crushed in spirit. Jesus almost is copying that in Matthew 11, where he says, "Come to me, you who are weary and are carrying heavy burdens. I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Learn from me." This idea of taking a yoke, that was also the term that they would use when someone was a rabbi. That if you would become their disciple and learn their teachings and follow that, that was taking their yoke. And Jesus is saying, come to me, learn to see the world the way that I see the world. Learn to react to things the way I react to things. Learn to love the things that I love. Learn to get frustrated about the things that I'm frustrated about. Learn to use my eyes. But he calls the weary. He calls the brokenhearted. I think he's often closer to those than the ones who feel like they got it all together and that God must be close to them. In Hebrews 4, we're given this awesome encouragement that we don't have a high priest or this intermediate person, this middleman, who doesn't understand us. Jesus does. So let's approach him so that we might find mercy and receive grace. Let's not run away from Jesus, because you know what? Jesus understands your physical body better than you do. He isn't surprised by chemicals or pulled tendons or anything like that. He understands your emotional well-being better than you do as well. He understands your spiritual well-being better than you do. And he wants to help you in that. And if I can encourage someone who's facing those types of struggles, get physical help. And that can look like doctors and medications. Get soul help. It can look like counselors or psychiatrists. Get spiritual help. And that looks like family and connection with God and knowing that he's close to you. What about the rest of us? Galatians chapter 6 is one that came to my mind in the last few days since I got the news. We're told that if someone is caught in sin, those who live by the Spirit should help that person, should help to restore them. Restore that person gently. He says this, carry each other's burdens. We're supposed to carry one another's burdens. That's what Jesus says, come to me, you who feel like you have heavy burdens on you, I'll give you rest. But it's not just for your own rest, but then we help carry one another's burdens. One of the things that got Jesus so angry, so frustrated, there's one time in the book of Luke where he's talking to these people that are the teachers of the law, and he says, you put on people burdens that they can't barely carry, and you won't even lift a finger to help them. That's the danger that happens so often in churches, is we learn how to look through the Bible to find what are the things you have to be doing right, and if you're not doing it right, I'll tell you you're doing it wrong, but I'm not going to really do anything to help you. That's dangerous, and that is something that Jesus hates. Jesus hates that. If we just give people a burden, but then don't help them with it. And he says, carry each other's burdens, and in so doing, you will fulfill the law of Christ. We see Jesus again. You want to follow what Christ said? We are there for each other to carry one another's burdens. Without comparing themselves to someone else, for each one should carry their own load. And that was the interesting thing in Galatians 6, where first he says, carry each other's burdens, and yet each one will carry their own load. What I make of this is two parts. One, we learn not to have to compare ourselves, where we go, wow, that person's struggling with that. I don't struggle with that. They must be a bad person. They have their own load. You have something else. We don't have to compare who is the one who's more Mr. Spiritual right now, or who is the one who has it easier or harder. This isn't about comparison. This is about how can we help each other to all get to a destination, not how can I get there faster than you. The second part of it is also so that we don't take on the guilt of other people's choices at times. Each one does have to carry their own load, and there are times where we do all we can to help someone carry it, and we offer, and we stand there, and we lift it up when they're not looking because they'll get mad at us when they do. But after everything that happens, they still choose to do something else. Each one must carry their own load, and we can't always walk around with the guilt and shame of what someone else has chosen when we have served and loved them to the end. That's why we look back at Jesus. Jesus had a friend, someone he invested in and served to the very last moment that he could. Explained it as clearly as I could see. And Judas didn't get it. And Jesus doesn't give up after that. And he doesn't say, you know what, humanity is screwed up and I give up. That's sometimes what we're tempted to do. I've tried so hard, it didn't work. Why even try? Jesus is sentenced to death. He's been betrayed. Hasn't been a great day, let's say that the least. And as he's carrying his cross, there are women who are mourning for him. And he says, women, weep for yourselves. And he pretty much says, it seems bad now. It's going to get worse. Jesus still has compassion for others. He still isn't looking at this is my own suffering. He's seeing this is going to get harder for you all. Then after that, he gets nailed onto a cross. He gets lifted up. There are people who are yelling at him and making fun of him all around. There are men who have taken his clothes, and even before he's dead, they're trying to decide who gets to have his clothes. And Jesus looks at them and says, Father, forgive them. He doesn't say, just like the rest, they all keep running away from God. He's still asking for mercy on people's lives. And we're told at one part that the two men that are being crucified with him are robbers, aren't good men, and we're told that they're hurling insults at him. And we don't really know when that moment is that one of them changes, but we're told that he says to the other one, don't you fear God? Don't you get it? We deserve this. Jesus doesn't. And he looks at Jesus and he says, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus doesn't say to him, I'm sorry, I'm a little busy right now. I've had a really bad day. He doesn't say, I already had a friend that betrayed me. I have another friend who has said he didn't even know me. Even after I told him he would say that, he still did it. And instead of giving up on people, Jesus continues. He realizes our brokenness. He realizes hurt. He realizes that we're not in a world that is all as it should be. But he doesn't give up on people. There's a quote from a movie. It's at the end after something very horrific has happened. And the last line, he says, Ernest Hemingway once wrote, the world is a fine place and worth fighting for. I believe the second part. The world has issues. It's not a fine place where everything goes good. And for us to somehow come up with this idea that, oh, everyone is intrinsically good all the time, well, then how come the junk that happens in this world has happened in the last week, month, year, thousands of years? The world isn't a fine place, and yet it is worth fighting for. Jesus didn't give up on people. So that's some of the way to respond when it's a personal tragedy, someone you know, someone that you've cared about. But what about impersonal tragedy? I mean, really, what do we do when the Malaysian Airlines flight gets destroyed and people from this country die? And we maybe know someone or know someone through another person. But how do we respond in that? What do we do when there are Christians who are having horrific torture being done to them in countries? The thing that at least helps me somewhat, in Luke 13, Jesus apparently had been out teaching, and then some people came to him and informed him that Pilate had butchered some Jews from Galilee as they were sacrificing at the temple in Jerusalem. And so people tell him this and sort of expect a response. What are you going to say about this, Jesus? This horrible thing has happened. This shameful thing has happened. Say something to us. And this is how Jesus responds. He said, do you think that they were worse sinners than other men from Galilee? Is that why they suffered? Not at all. And don't you realize that you also will perish unless you leave your evil ways and turn to God? What about the 18 men who died when the Tower of Siloam fell on them? Were they the worst sinners in Jerusalem? Not at all. And you too will perish unless you repent. Just because something bad happens doesn't mean God doesn't like you. Doesn't mean that you're the worst sinner in the world. Or just because something bad has happened to someone else doesn't somehow find the way to categorize us. And Jesus makes that clear. But he also tells us to keep eternity in mind. To look beyond just a tragedy, and we should use those as a way to reassess for ourselves. Am I living like today might be my last day? Am I living in a way that is pointed toward God or not? At the end of the first one, he says, unless you turn from your evil ways, and the second time he says, you repent, and I don't understand the Greek well enough to prove this, but in one of the things I read, they said that these two words, it's the same word, but because of verb tense of how it's used, one of them is talking about a one-time act of repenting, a one-time act of turning towards God. And the other one is talking about a continuous thing of continually redirecting ourselves back to God. So he's saying that both of those are important. It's not just, I said, oh, I prayed one time, I raised my hand, I'm good, and then I go throughout my life not caring about God. He says, no, you have to make that choice, and you have to continue in it. The example of what happened to these people when Pilate had butchered them, we don't know exactly what that story was, but there's another one from just before Jesus started teaching that seems similar to it. And so we can see Pilate was not a good guy. See, Pilate was this Roman governor who was over the area, and he decided that he wanted an aqueduct to be built that would flow into Jerusalem. So he goes to the temple and says, I'm going to use some of your money, that way I can build this aqueduct that I want. It would be like the Dutch government coming into our church and saying, I'm going to take some of the money that people have given, that way we can keep building the A2 tunnel. And people would be like, excuse me, we didn't give toward that, and you take my taxes anyway. Use the taxes, but this was given for a specific purpose. I gave this to God, and if it doesn't get used for that, then it's problematic for me because then I'm not even able to worship God the way I'm supposed to. They elect like this delegation, I guess, to go and say, can we get our money back? And when they do that, Pilate had sent some Roman guards dressed as normal people to stand among the crowd, and then at his signal, had them all pull out daggers and butcher all the people that had come to say, excuse me, can we have our money back? Pilate wasn't a nice guy. We sometimes don't get his ruthlessness, because in the situation with Jesus, he seems like he's a little scared and doesn't know what to do. But there was a real reason why the Jews didn't want to stay under Roman rule. And so many times, as we look through the Bible, there are people who get to this like, oh, the people at the time totally didn't understand. Jesus didn't come to bring a military rule. He came for something spiritual. And that's true. but I actually understand why they really wanted some kind of militaristic leader. When you have an instance happen like that where first your money gets stolen, and then when you ask for it back, your people get killed, that makes you a little unhappy. And that makes you go, God, this isn't right. This isn't the way government should be done. This isn't the way it should be. This isn't what you promised us would be. And so I understand when they go, God, why is it like this? And I'm sure there are Christians today living in countries that can have just the same, like, God, can't you just come in and, I don't know, make the whole army of the bad people die right away so that we won't keep having this happen. I can get that, and I can desire the same thing for him. But Jesus tells us, keep our eyes, keep our minds on eternity. Because whether you die tomorrow or die in 15 years or whenever it is, we will still die, and are we prepared? If you need that, there'll be some people up here that are willing to pray with you. You'll have that opportunity. But for those that, at the moment, maybe you aren't facing that kind of dark period in your life, I'm still asking you, are you willing to serve people no matter what the outcome? Are you willing to not give up? So your Jesus life step, serve someone that you think might be a hopeless cause. The ones that you're tempted to consider that, don't give up on them. Jesus, to the very last, served. And then even after one loss, he kept serving and kept his eyes on others. If you need help, ask. Don't give up on people. And remember that what we do matters for eternity.